WVW Broadcast Network is pleased to present The Chris Gobbett Show. Chris is a national security consultant, speaker, and conservative commentator. As the lead undercover researcher in one of the most successful post-9/11 undercover operations in the United States, Gobbett's posed as a Muslim convert and gained access to Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas-backed organization leadership meetings. While undercover, he preserved more than 12,000 pages of evidence and 300 hours of covert audio and video recordings from the Council on American Islamic Relations headquarters. This undercover operation is the feature of Muslim Mafia, a book authored by investigative journalists Paul Sperry and Dave Gobbett. Chris's father, Gobbett, has been featured on numerous global media networks, national television shows, and radio programs, including The Sean Hannity Show, Tipping Point with Liz Wheeler, The Savage Nation, Breitbart News Daily, and Louder with Crowder. And now, here is your host, Chris Gobbett.
Welcome to the show tonight. I'm Chris Gobbett with WVW Broadcast Network. Tonight I have a very special guest. We're going to be talking about national security with Claire Lopez, the Vice President for Research and Analysis at the Center for Security Policy. Claire, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Let's talk about national security, shall we?
Sounds good, and thanks for having me. I'm very glad to be with you both.
Oh, we're certainly glad to have you. Okay, so let's talk. Now, you just had a recent blog post. Did you say, we were talking about this before the show started, did you say it's on Newsmax now about the IRGC
yes.
designation?
Newsmax has very graciously granted me my own blog, and along with a whole bunch of other wonderful folks who have theirs there, too. And I've only published a few things there now so far, three or four. Maybe this is the fourth or fifth. I don't know. In view of yesterday's announcement by President Donald Trump and, of course, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, designating the Iranian Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or IRGC, sometimes called the Pasdaran, to the U.S. Foreign Terrorist Organizations list, I dashed off a short commentary for the blog, and it just went up at Newsmax today. You can find it at my Twitter, which is my name, Claire M. Lopez, at Claire M. Lopez, or at my Facebook page, same thing, my name. Or, of course, you can go to Newsmax itself, to the, its list of blog posters. And basically what I said in the article is that I really applaud the move to name the IRGC to the FTO list. The only thing I would say is that I, in my opinion, think it's about 18 years too late. And I said that because of the known, documented, legally concluded involvement of the Iranian regime, as well as Hezbollah, it's a Lebanese Shiite terror proxy, in the attacks of 9/11. And that's never really been acknowledged. It's never really been public or commented on by any U.S. Administration from George W. Bush through Barack Obama or even now the Donald Trump administration. So putting the IRGC on the list is absolutely the right move. And, they deserve support and praise for that. But I would like to see a complete explanation of the full reason why they deserve to be named to that list. And it doesn't begin just with the IRGC providing explosive devices to the Iraqi Shiite militias and other militias that killed our troops and other coalition troops, as well as many Iraqis. It doesn't begin there. It begins way, way back, certainly as far back as 1990, which is the year in late 1990 when the current, maybe not long for this world, or not long for his post, I should say, president, Muslim Brotherhood president of Sudan, whose name is Omar al-Bashir. Mm-hmm. I said perhaps not long for his post because you may have seen huge demonstrations going on around the government buildings in downtown Khartoum these last few days. But it was him. It was Bashir who in 1990 invited jihadis of the world, PLO, the PFLP, that is the Palestinian jihad terror groups, plus Hezbollah was invited, plus the entire top leadership of the Iranian government at the time. And indeed, the entire top level of the Iranian government came to Khartoum. The president at that time was Ali Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, now deceased. The head of the intelligence service of Iran, Ali Falahian, was there. The head of the IRGC, whose name is Mohsen Rezai, some of these guys still around and part of the regime, all came. But the draw was that in that year, 1990, just after the end of the war in Afghanistan against the USSR, some of the jihadis that were just beginning to coalesce into what would become known as Al-Qaeda, that is Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, and others, had found safe haven in Sudan. Omar al-Bashir had given them safe haven in Sudan because their own countries, for very good reasons, didn't want them back. And so they all joined there in Khartoum that year and also met later in following years there, too. But they formed an alliance, the alliance that our national security gurus to this day say could never happen, which is the Shiite-Sunni alliance. So again, the top leadership of Iran, of Hezbollah, Shiites, plus what was becoming and coalescing as Al-Qaeda, together with the Muslim Brotherhood government regime of Omar al-Bashir, and they formed a terror operational alliance. And so this is all in my article. And what followed upon that was the agreement that Iran directed its top terror chieftain of Hezbollah, whose name was Emad Mugniyeh, to train the Al-Qaeda cadres, the operatives, on how to do big building suicide truck bombings, like Hezbollah had done back in Lebanon, 1983, to our embassy, to our Marine Corps barracks, to the French embassy as well, and to their troops too. But that was organized and directed by Hezbollah, by Emad Mugniyeh. So in Khartoum now, bin Laden says, hey, Rafsanjani, I really like what your Hezbollah guys do with big bomb explosives. Can you teach my guys how to do that? And of course, Iran said yes and directed Emad Mugniyeh to teach Al-Qaeda how to do that. And what followed? We've got 1996 Khobar Towers, got 1998 U.S. East Africa, Nairobi, Dar es Salaam embassy bombings. You've got USS Cole, our naval ship, blown up and almost sunk in harbor in Yemen. And then, of course, 9/11 itself. Those were all collaborations between Iran, or among Iran, Hezbollah, and Al-Qaeda.
So let me ask you this, Claire. You brought up a couple of things that I want to dive into a little more. First off, it's been, 18 years the IRGC should have been designated a terrorist group. What brought this on now, specifically now? And then let's move into why have we not heard, for the people watching right now that oftentimes get their news from even Fox News, why have we not heard more about Iran's involvement in 9/11?
Very, very good question, and I wish I knew the answer to it, really. But here's what I can say, that certainly after 9/11, President George W. Bush did not want to talk about the Iranian or Hezbollah involvement. Really, we let Saudi Arabia off the hook, too. Mm-hmm. It's just that I'm saying that they, they are also part of this, and I should name them, of course, the Taliban as well. But we're focusing on Iran because of the designation mm-hmm. yesterday. And so George W. Bush did not want to talk about that. You know why? Because after 9/11, one of the former Taliban warlords named Gulbuddin Yekmiatar, who had fallen out with the Taliban and had been living in Iran in safe haven there under the protection of the IRGC Quds Force and Ministry of Intelligence and Security, or MOIS, of Iran for several years prior to 9/11. He, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, he's back in the Taliban's good graces, by the way, now, back in Afghanistan. He arranged one of the bolt holes, or one of the escape routes, for Al-Qaeda. It wasn't the only one. There were other escape routes through the mountains with Pakistan, on down into towns, cities like Quetta and so forth. But this one was to the west. This one went across the Afghan border into Iran, and he arranged for Osama bin Laden, wives, children, other fighters, families, to escape the final battles of Tora Bora out of Afghanistan and to go into Iran, where it was agreed. Now listen to this. It was agreed among the governments of the United States of America, Saudi Arabia, Iran, plus Al-Qaeda, that Osama bin Laden would be permitted to live in safe haven in Iran post 9/11. Mm-hmm. He lived there, as did many of his family members, other fighters, and some of them, by the way, are still there. Osama bin Laden himself stayed there until about somewhere in 2010, and that's when he moved to Abbottabad in Pakistan, the place where he was hunted down and killed in May of 2011. But because of that agreement, nobody wanted in the Bush administration, certainly not the Barack Obama administration, and even to this date, the Trump administration, to acknowledge the Iranian Hezbollah role in 9/11 or what our government agreed to in the aftermath.
So this is something, and I don't mean to cut you off, Claire, but I really want people to hear this and to drill down a little bit more on that specific point. There's no way, in other words, that President Bush didn't know about this. Obviously, this was something that the commander-in-chief would have had to have been made aware of.
He was party to the agreement.
So how do we know that? For people that are going to be incredibly skeptical, as you should be skeptical, how do we know this information? When did this information come to the public's light? Because I want people to do their own homework on this and see that what you're saying is absolutely true.
Right. Well, certain individuals known to me knew about this for a long time, but it really just came out into the public very recently, I think within the last several months, maybe late 2018, and I would have to look up exactly which article it was.
Okay.
But it was finally written, publicly posted in the media, that this was the agreement that happened after 9/11. I have no idea why they did this, why they allowed this to happen.
And this is part of, now this is something, if people want to learn a little bit more about Iran's involvement and Saudi's involvement too, you have the 28 redacted pages from the 9/11 Commission report, and then you also have the
Actually, no, that was from the Congressional report.
Okay. And then you also
have the
Havlish case. So can you talk a little bit about the Havlish case? Because you were involved in that.
Exactly, and this is also part of something that I wrote into this new Newsmax blog that just posted today. So in the aftermath of 9/11, widows of the pilots, a couple of the pilots, and also other family and survivors from 9/11, came to a law firm in Pennsylvania and asked that law firm to please investigate and get to the bottom of what really happened with the death of their loved ones and so many others on 9/11, because they did not trust the U.S. government to do that. Let that sink in. They came to a law firm. That law firm eventually grew to a consortium of, I think it was 8 or 9 law firms together. And now here's the interesting part. In the beginning, this group, this legal group, was focused on Iraq, on Saddam Hussein. And they were pursuing any information they could find that would connect Saddam Hussein to the attacks of 9/11. Well, there came a point in time when about mid-2000s, 05 or 06 perhaps, they realized that's a dead end. Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. which is not to say that, you know, he was a good guy or should not have been overthrown later on, but he had nothing to do with 9/11. He did give safe haven to al-Qaeda later and helped out Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, but that's another story. In this case, he had nothing to do with 9/11. So at that point, the legal team pivoted to look at Iran. And they brought different people onto the team. Ken Timmerman, a renowned, notable author and writer, journalist. And I came into the team about 2009. It was really towards the end. But I teamed up with a friend and a colleague named Dr. Bruce Teft, who's a former agency officer and with long experience in Africa. And he and I teamed up to write one of the affidavits for the Havlish legal case. Havlish, by the way, is the name of one of the widows. We gave her name to the case. That's why Havlish. And so... our affidavit that we co-wrote together is about the history of some of what I was just telling you and the audience here, the history of the Iran-Hezbollah-Al-Qaeda relationship. Yes, this does leave out Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia absolutely had a part to play in this, but the focus here, just for the purpose of what we're talking about today, was Iran and Hezbollah together with Al-Qaeda. And so we wrote the affidavit of the history of that relationship, and we took it back, just as I just told you, to Omar al-Bashir and the Muslim Brotherhood regime in Khartoum in Sudan, and brought it all the way forward. And we had many other affidavits written in this case. I wish I could direct the audience to a website, which we had up for a long time, together with links to all the affidavits. I'll give it to you anyway, because we're technical people are working on getting it back up. Okay. There were some glitches, some problems, but you can go eventually. Keep trying. www.iran911case.com. And at one of the tabs called Exhibits were all the affidavits. Other people like... The famed Judge Bougier of France, Clausen, I'm blanking on his first name, from the Washington Institute of Near East Affairs, also wrote affidavits. And then a very important affidavit was written by an expert on passports and travel. Janice Kephart is her name. And she wrote an affidavit which was very key to this, and it draws in Saudi Arabia. I'll tell you about it here real quickly.
Okay.
So this is also something that does appear in the 9/11 Commission report itself, that, you know, very thick, what is it, 600, 500 something page report that came out in August of 2004 on the 9/11 attacks. But Janice wrote an affidavit in which she described how the hijackers, who were Saudis, 15 of the 19 were Saudis, how those 15 Saudis got into the United States with clean passports, because they did. They got in with passports and visas. How'd that happen? Well, what happened is that Iran and Saudi Arabia came to an agreement that a mark would be placed in those Saudis' brand new Saudi passports, which they all got brand new. Do not know to this day what the mark was, because that remains classified, but something. And that then between the Iranians and the Saudis, the Iranian border guards were instructed on what to look for, and if that mark appeared in the passport, to let them through without stamping the passport. Hmm. And that's how... these jihadis, these hijackers, the Saudis, could travel, and they did. They were traveling all over the Middle East in the months leading up to 9/11. They had briefings, they had training in Iran, they were in Beirut, they were in Afghanistan, and they went back and forth, and their passports were never stamped because of these agreements. Now, the fact that they were traveling is also in the 9/11 Commission report, and there's a page there where it actually talks about they were accompanied on their flights around the Middle East by, it's said in the 9/11 Commission report, a senior official of Hezbollah. And they don't name him, but the name is Imad Mughniyeh, top terror chieftain of Hezbollah, the one responsible for the kidnapping, murder, torture of Bill Buckley, our CIA Beirut station chief, of Colonel Rich Higgins, the Marine Corps colonel, likewise kidnapped, tortured, killed by Hezbollah. That's Imad Mughniyeh, same guy responsible for the 1992 and 1994 suicide bombings in Buenos Aires, Venezuela. Argentina, Buenos Aires, Argentina, against first instance the Israeli embassy, and then the second 194 Jewish Cultural Center. That's Imad Mughniyeh, who was in Khartoum for the first jihad jamboree, as I call it. Anyway, all of this has to do with the Havlish case. If anybody is interested, by the way, it is all open source. Everything we wrote was open source. Now, we looked up things, we delved into all kinds of documents, we spoke to people also in person, but it's open source. And you know, if anybody would like that affidavit, I'm willing to send it to them if they want to make a request.
Well, and you know, you bring up something that's really interesting that a lot of people aren't aware of. When we talk about intelligence and information, whether it's what's going on the international scene or domestically, the vast majority of information out there, even intelligence agencies look to, a majority of it is open source. It's not so much that
the only problem is they don't look to open source. That's the problem.
But over the information is there, is what I mean. Yeah,
is open source, but they don't use it.
Yeah,
they think everything of value is contained in little black boxes.
Yeah, no, and that's such a huge misconception.
What's going on? Probably 90-something percent of what's going on.
Yeah, no, it's all out there. And really the key is not that there's a lack of information, it's that there's so much information out there. A lot of times people don't know where to start, and this is why, you know, they can tune in here to WVW Broadcast Network. Center for Security Policy and your work is phenomenal. I check it at least once a week. You have the best researchers, the best analysts on national security issues. And I have to say, for people that aren't aware, you've authored or been a part of several monographs on the Center for Security Policy. I know you've worked on the Gulen movement, a movement a lot of Americans are not aware of. Center for Security Policy, you go to centerforsecuritypolicy.com, look at press, and look at all of the books and monographs that are available. There's so much information on your website. There was something.
By the way, that is centerforsecuritypolicy.org. Or a shorter URL, place. It goes to the same place. Is securefreedom.org.
Okay, thank you .org. So let me ask you this, Claire. We have about 5 minutes left. Something. There's two things that I want to talk about. Something recently, speaking of Center for Security Policy, is Diana West recently came out with a monograph called The Red Thread. A lot of people would be absolutely shocked to realize that this anti-Trump conspiracy really leads back ideologically to a Marxist movement here in the United States. I know that's not shocking to us, but to a lot of Americans it would be. Anything on the horizon that we should be looking about out on Center for Security Policy Press, or just in general from your organization?
Well, thank you for mentioning these books, and yes, we have quite a number already published, and if you go to our website, www.centerforsecuritypolicy.org, and look at the top tab where it says publications, you'll find the list of them. Diana West's Red Thread is riveting reading. Mm-hmm. She is a superb researcher and writer. I have the pleasure of editing many of these monographs, well, all of these monographs, this one is a must-read. It is indeed about the red thread of Marxism in terms of contacts, in terms of professors, in terms of academic background, of a number of the players at the heart of the recent attempted coup d'etat against our President Trump. I'll name just one of those names, which is Nellie Orr, might ring a bell for some folks, deeply stewed in Marxist contacts and education going back to university days. Coming up, I will give you a sneak peek. Very soon we shall be releasing two more monographs. We're almost finished with the editing. Jim Simpson, another fabulous writer, has written a new monograph we call the Red Green Axis 2. It follows up the first one he did a couple of years ago. And then the other one coming out soon will be Ilana Friedman's Hamas 2. You might recall the first one she wrote was about Hamas Care, the Muslim Brotherhood here in America. This new one, Hamas 2, is about the organization as it exists in the Middle East, as the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah, and it's just something, you know, this show is really about encouraging people. There's a lot of people around the country. They live in cities all over the country. They're not near Washington, D.C., many of them. I would say most people watching this are not near Washington, D.C. And sometimes people feel demoralized. They feel like they can't do anything. And I would encourage people that you can be informed. There are places like Center for Security Policy that are doing phenomenal work as it pertains to national security. But at the end of the day, you've got to take that information and disseminate it to people at your in your local community. You've got to get more involved at the local level. We've already got a lot of good people like yourself and like Frank Gaffney at the Center for Security Policy doing great work as it pertains to national security. But you have to do something. If you live out in Des Moines, Iowa, if you live anywhere in the Midwest, if you live anywhere outside of Washington, D.C., it's really going to be about getting involved at the local level. And you have great resources for informing people. These monographs are really good resources. And so I just encourage people that it's you may not be able to necessarily go to Washington, D.C. and get involved that way, but you can take what's going on and use the resources that are out there. I just want to say thank you so much for coming on, Claire. I really do appreciate your time. I know you're incredibly busy. In the next minute, anything that people should be looking out for that's going on the national scene, whether it's in the Middle East or here at home domestically, to keep their eyes on as it pertains to national security?
Yeah, I'll mention something I think is pretty important, and I just came earlier today from a fantastic panel and presentation of what we're calling Committee on the Present Danger, China. Okay. A new organization that Frank Gaffney has formed, and we had a terrific lineup of speakers today at the Reserve Officers Association up on Capitol Hill, including Senator Ted Cruz came by, also Steve Bannon spoke, Gordon Chang, always an expert, it was all videotaped and recorded. You can find it at our website, centerforsecuritypolicy.org. There were other cameras there, too. I don't know from which all news media, but certainly you can go to the center's website and catch that full lineup of wonderful speakers today.
Well, thank you so much, Claire. I wish we had more time, but be well, and thank you so much for coming on. And for those of you watching right now, this has been a great show. I highly encourage you to go to centerforsecuritypolicy.org and look at some of the work that Claire and others at the Center for Security Policy are doing as it pertains to national security. But at the end of the day, I'm encouraging you to get more involved at the local level. So thank you for your time tonight. And if you want to, I am committed between now and November of 2020 to speaking to as many conservative groups as possible. So if you'd like me to come out and speak to your group, go to wvwtv.com/Chris and ask me to come out. I'd be glad to do that. Thank you for watching, and we'll catch you next time.